Stay tuned for Our Recourse with Brian Gale, coming up next.
Amen.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Our Recourse, a one-hour radio show named in honor of the Immaculate Mother of God, hosted by Brian Gale. As Pope Francis says, Jesus Christ is the mercy of God, and as our beloved Church has long taught, His Mother is our ever-faithful recourse to that mercy. So sit back for the next hour and enjoy Our Recourse with Brian Gale.
Hi, I'm Brian Gale. Welcome to Our Recourse. We have a great guest today, and I couldn't be more excited about introducing him to you. His name is Edmund Patrick Gregory Adamus, and he is a recognized authority on the teaching of the Catholic Church on pretty much everything, but in particular on the sacrament of marriage, marriage preparation, John Paul II's teaching of the theology of the body, and marriage healing. My friend Edmund has spoken at conferences across Europe, North America, South America, and Australia, offering his expertise to thousands of people regarding the pastoral care of married couples. He's been an international keynote speaker on theology of the body for the past 25 years, and I really could go on and on. Let me just say that he's among the Catholic Church's foremost experts on the family and its challenges in this age of the death culture. And I am delighted to introduce him to this Philadelphia audience of In His Sign Network. Edmund, welcome.
Thank you, Brian. It's very kind of you.
So good to have you on. So good to hear your voice. It's been a while. We were last together at the World Meeting of Families. Edmund was in.
Yeah.
I arranged for him to speak at Malvern to a pro-life group, and it was an indelible experience for all of us who were there. And I am so delighted again that you have made the time from your extraordinarily busy schedule as Director of Family and Marriage in the Diocese of Westminster in London, England. So to our listeners, this man is calling from London, and we are ever grateful that he is with us. And Edmund, let's just begin by talking about the family and the challenges that it's facing today. And you've been a longtime observer of how these challenges have deepened and darkened over the years. What are you seeing over there, which is really the epicenter of the culture of death, is it not?
Yes, I think in many respects, Britain, UK, and London in particular, is in many respects... one could say it's the genesis of the culture of death. Here it was where post-Enlightenment and Darwinism was born, and eugenics by Sir Francis Galton, and then, of course, the ever-pervading and pre- survival and eugenicist movement under Mary Stopes, who of course was a key partner with Margaret Sanger over there in the States. And of course, I would say the pivotal historical and ecclesial moment for civilization, not just the church, but for civilization, was of course the break that the Anglican Union made in the Lambeth Conference of 1930 with the millennial teaching against contraception. And it was that first rupture, if you like, formal rupture in a Christian body that said, in certain circumstances, separating the unitive from the procreative in the conjugal act was permissible. And of course, as the saying goes, the rest is history. And we've seen how, since 1930, in Britain and elsewhere in the world, that contraceptive mentality, Pope St. John Paul used to refer to it, then feeds the culture, which then feeds off death rather than life, and death-oriented choices, both morally and physically, as opposed to life-giving, joy-filled, procreative choices of holiness and you know, here we are. I only read yesterday a headline where I think there are ethicists in Britain who are going to create animal hybrid embryonic chimeras for, you know, proposed, you know, bioengineering, biogenetic, clinical purposes to create disease for human beings. But, you know, even the most liberal of scientists are saying, well, wait on a minute, what's the ethics of this? But here we are. These kind of things seem to always emerge from Britain, and it does make you think.
Well, 99 years ago, this year, Our Lady, after whom this show and actually this network is really named and consecrated, said at Fatima to the children that the final attack, the final battle between the powers and principalities would involve a massive attack on the family. Mm. And is that not what we're seeing? And tell us what form it's taking.
Well, I think we've been seeing a gradual build-up of this, I would say, certainly since the so-called sexual revolution of the 60s. But even before that, you know, the advent of the birth control mentality predates the 60s by some measure. And you had, you know, key teachings of Pius XI, Pius XII, and then the Council, of course, which upheld the beautiful vision of the church for authentic human sexuality, and that wonderful document on human life, Humanae Vitae, by Blessed Pope Paul VI, which Pope John Paul II tried in all of his 27 years of his pontificate to really drive home, as it were, both by his example, by his love of the family, by the way he gloried in matrimonial love and fidelity as a priest. He tried to drive home this vision that, you know, this isn't just a high ideal, this is a norm, this is a normative pattern of behavior and God's plan for us. But of course, as we know, you know, against the darkening shift in social mores around us, his prophetic voice was becoming ever more drowned out. So we're at the stage now where, in a sense, one could argue with the onset of same-sex marriage and whole debate about gender ideology, transgenderism, which of course, as we're reading over here, looking at you guys in the States, we're reading stories about the so-called bathroom wars, you know, and this is yet another symptom of this anti-family, anti-life, anti-marriage mentality, and which is just, it is satanic. There's no question in my mind. It's definitely of diabolic nature. And I've just started doing some very interesting work. We've been trying to run three times a year some really, really rich retreats for married couples. Just a Saturday and a Sunday, nothing too heavy out of their busy life. And we don't get many takers. It's really hard to get couples to sign up and on a weekend, very small numbers. So by way of enticing people towards going on, I've developed this little three-hour workshop, which just kind of gently but firmly challenges spouses, either together or a spouse can come on their own to the workshop, gently, you know, lead them to a deeper understanding of the need for a better communication, dialogue, and in order to achieve that, you've got to, you know, let go of resentments, maybe, if there's some lingering there in your relationship, even if your marriage is pretty stable, and entrust the surrendering of those resentments, the grace of God, and ask for real healing and lasting forgiveness in your marriage, and let past hurts go. Because so many marriages are in a kind of relationship gridlock. And it's not any, in most cases, it's not ill will on part of both the spouses. It's just they need a bit of a nudge to get over the hump. And so I've been started doing this work, and I'm getting some pretty good numbers coming up. Probably 3 hours, and it's not too demanding. But there's a real, what I'm discovering is there's a real hunger in the hearts of husbands and wives for help. And these are the stable unions. These are the ones who are at the Mass, saying their prayers, receiving the sacraments. And what I've been saying to them, inspired by the Lord, is to say, when we get towards the end of this workshop, is to say, you know, all of these tips and these ideas, for useful strategies to improve your relationship are fine. They're good human skills and choose to try and cultivate and concretize life. But here's the thing. You can't bring a knife to a gun battle. We can't just rely on our natural resources to pursue and win a supernatural battle. Marriage is at the forefront, at the vanguard of a supernatural battle in the world. It always was, but it ever more so today. And one of the things I've been saying to couples is, you know, if you're sometimes feeling a bit aggrieved with your partner, with your spouse, because, you know, that you're fully reconciled, maybe you're fighting the wrong enemy.
That's good.
Don't fight your wife. Don't fight your husband. Your real enemy is who's invaded your home and invaded your union is Satan, the father of lies. And what's he doing? He's whispering lies into your heart. The ear of your heart against your spouse, because we often tend to exaggerate the faults of our spouse. We do, you know. But as Jesus said, you know, see the log in your own eye first before you look at the splinter in your brother's. You know, and we've got to embrace that gospel value, matrimony as well. So one of the things I say to them, look, you know, you're not on your own. Grace is with you. Mantle of Our Lady wants to shadow you in your union. She wants your union to flourish. And the graces of the sacrament of matrimony are not just something you received on your wedding, but they are something to tap into every single month, every day of your life, however long or short you've been married.
I don't want to jump in.
You need to be more intentional and deliberate about. Really be deliberate about this is because, you know what? Satan has a target on your back.
I think that's the case.
Hates your spouse. He hates the fact that you've committed to your spouse. And he will do anything in his power to disrupt and rupture what you have. So your enemy, ultimately, however aggrieved you might feel sometimes, it's your husband. However they've hurt you or you down, your real enemy is not them, but the prince of the father of life. And The great thing is we know he's been beaten. He's been conquered. So let's use the spiritual weapons at our disposal, the rosary, devotions, fidelity to the sacraments, living a sacramental Eucharistic life, praying together as husband and wife, not just going to Mass together, though that is important, but really praying together as one, striving for that alignment of heart, spirit, soul, mind, and body, so that the home, the domestic church, is the powerhouse of grace that protects the people within the four walls, but emanates and emits grace without. There's a wonderful phrase that Pope Francis had in the recent document, Amoris Laetitia, The Joy of Love, where he talks about the parish being a family of family. Now, this isn't a new phrase, but Benedict used it during his pontificate, and it was kind of inherent as well in Paul's teaching. But it's interesting to see in Pope Francis's post-synodal apostolic exhortation, because, of course, there's been a huge spotlight on family in a very intense way in the with the synods and everything else, controversial debate. But essentially, what the Holy Father is saying in that document is the same as always been said, which is, you know, the domestic church is the heart of the church, the life and mission of the church, the Christian house, and at the heart of that Christian household is the spousal union, and husbands and wives have always been and must always be the primary agents of evangelization. Now, if I'm an agent of evangelization, I need grace. And I can only have grace, rely on grace, to help me fulfill that apostolate to evangelize and be evangelized by my wife, and for me to evangelize her, our children, and neighborhood, and our role in the parish. And so it goes on, you know, kind of exponentially, you know, goes outward from your union to others. And often, you know, couples are emitting and transmitting grace and love and matrimonial harmony, often without them even realizing they're doing it. It's like a secret, sacred transmission, an airwave emitting from. We all know great couples, don't we? And we've all come across and do come across some of the most sublime marriages. Look at those couples and we think, they're such a beautiful couple. What a witness they are. Because they edify us just by being themselves. And that's where Pope Francis is absolutely right when he talks about the union of an icon. It's like looking at an icon of the Blessed Trinity. And that's what we should be about. We should be lifting up the hearts and edifying our struggling marriages. These poor spouses around who are, they're just overburdened and worn down with the cares of modern life, and they're worried sick about their children, immorality that they're trying to raise their children, the culture they're trying to raise their children in. They're worn down, they're overburdened. And there's only one place you can go when you're overburdened. Sacred Heart of Christ, in and through his we just need to find ways to articulate to people that there is hope, there is a way out, there is refreshment, there is renewal, and it's there for the asking.
I have to ask you, Edmund, how did we get here? It was impossible to see this coming in the 50s and even in the 60s, although the 60s it began to shake loose.
You'll have to excuse me, Brian. It's a very faint line. I'm not quite hearing you clearly enough.
All right, let me repeat the question. How did we get here? In the 50s, when I was coming up, even in the 60s, when I was a teenager, I don't think any of us saw this coming and saw the depth of you know, where we would end up as a society. What happened?
Well, I think it's think it's, looking back now with hindsight, I think it's clear that Pope Paul's profoundly prophetic statement in Humanae Vitae in 1968, which is probably the most bitterly rejected church document of the history of the church on birth control. But of course we know it wasn't just about birth control. The document says a whole lot more than just paragraph 14 about artificial birth control being morally wrong. But we know, don't we, that everything he predicted, that he said would happen if contraception just becomes the norm in conjugal life and outside of conjugal life, all of these all of this kind of symptoms of moral decay would start to happen, which was, as we know, the kind of infidelity and promiscuity, diminishment of respect for women, for girls, pornography. The list was quite long, and of course many things since then have happened which he couldn't have possibly predicted, such as IVF and embryonic experimentation and abortion on demand, to say nothing of the whole homosexualist agenda and the gay rights lobby and all of the permutations coming from that. So there's a sense in which I guess one could, in a sense, pinpoint the seismic shift taking place in society, which also affected the life of the church, was at that point in the early to mid-60s, where there was the growing acceptance, if you like, of separating the unitive from the procreative aspects of marital love as the norm. Particularly with the advent of the pill. And it was almost as if, looking back, because it was almost as if the church was caught off guard. Like a rabbit in the headlights. It just kind of didn't know which way to turn. And I think to some extent, though Pope Paul's document Humanae Vitae is absolutely emphatically clear and irreformable truth, one could say that by the time of July 1968 was issued, that was almost, one could say, almost too little too late, because the damage was done. You know, Gene was out of the way. Interestingly enough, there was, I think it was about 1995, I think, correct, and it was a lecture delivered by then Cardinal Ratzinger, Joseph Ratzinger, as head of the Congregation for the Faith. He was giving a very erudite lecture on the challenges facing the church in Europe and evangelization. And he was delivering this lecture to all of the heads of national theological commissions of European countries. And it was published by L'Osservatore Romano, the Vatican newspaper. It's a worthwhile read. It's very academic, but it's a worthwhile read, because he basically says what he refers to as the litany of dissent outside and inside the church, that, you know, that, you know, the church needs to update teachings on sexual ethics, and it's outmoded on just an all-male priesthood, and it should give the celibacy obligation, and all of these things which, you know, we've heard ad infinitum over the years. He calls this litany of dissent is traceable to the abandonment of the metaphysical, and in particular the theology of creation in the life of the church. And then he says we can actually trace that to the almost universal acceptance and embracing of the hormonal contraceptive pill into the life of marriage and the family.
We talk about nailing it, huh?
Yeah. And an extraordinary piece of writing, and you kind of think, yeah, no, he's right. I mean, but I have hope. I mean, I as you know, Brian, we were in touch again more recently because I was over in at Ave Maria University at the end of January there, in Florida, and it was a two-day conference looking at Humanae Vitae, almost 50 years on now, from lots of different academic and scientific aspects. So there were about two dozen or so speakers of the younger generation, younger than me even by 20 years, young Catholic theologians, economists, scientists, social theorists, political scientists, as well as theologians and clinicians, all looking at the truth of the document from their own particular disciplines and producing evidence to say, yeah, you know, Paul was right. And 50 years on, we can prove he's right because the data is all saying this, this, and this. And it was wonderful to be in the company of like-minded individuals, as it always is, but to be in the company of seriously studied, reflective professionals, wonderfully committed Catholics, who were born long after 1968, but who see the truth of Humanae Vitae for itself, because they're living it. They're just getting on and living that vision, and then finding the resonance they need for the truth they're living from the different disciplines that they have expertise in. So the hope is that this conference and others like it will produce a publication in time for the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae in 2018. By way of saying to the wider church, and in particular to older theologians, if you like, who kind of still quite vocally dissent from Humanae Vitae, to say, look, you know, we're the younger generation here. We don't quite have the baggage of, or we don't have any of the baggage of the sexual revolution of the 60s. We've seen Humanae Vitae. We've embraced Humanae Vitae. We live Humanae Vitae. And we just do not know, we don't understand where your dissent is coming from, period. Because that's not the truth and the reality we're seeing. So I think in time, like all of these things, when you look at the history of the church, things go in cycles. I'm quietly confident, you know, in a generation or two, the impact of the clearly committed younger lay and ordained and religious theologians and experts in various fields will just be able to amplify, say, that irreformable truth that Pope Paul VI so beautifully articulated in the briefest of papal documents back in 1968.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, as they say, I want to open the lines and invite our listeners to call in and ask Edmund Adamus a question or two about the family, about the death culture, about Vatican II, about Humanae Vitae. After the break, we're going to get into theology of the body, which George Weigel once proclaimed was a ticking time bomb that would go off at the beginning of the 21st century. And my guess is that, Edmund, you've seen it go off. You were part of the people that helped to detonate it. But our telephone lines are 610-527-2906. That's 610-527-2906 or 1-888-343-2484. That's 1-888-343-2484. And I think we are about ready for a break. Okay, so hang on, please. And Edmund, please hold on with us.
Have you ever heard of seed faith, the biblical law of sowing and reaping? Many people fail when it comes to faith for finances because they haven't planted any seed. Any farmer knows that if you want a good crop, you have to first sow the seed. The Bible speaks about seed right from the beginning in Genesis, and it's brought up all throughout the Scriptures. In the second book of Corinthians, we are told that whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, but whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Why not consider sowing your financial seed into In His Sign Catholic Radio, a ministry with a 30-year history? You should sow your financial seed into a ministry that produces good fruit. Luke tells us at chapter 6, verse 44, every tree is known by its fruit. You should sow your financial seeds where you're fed, be it here, your local parish, or other worthy ministries. Please prayerfully consider joining our monthly circle of family and friends by partnering with us financially each month. All donations are completely tax deductible and go directly to our daily expenses, like the purchase of radio airtime and keeping the lights on. Kathleen McCarthy and all of the staff at In His Sign, except Kathleen's administrator, donate all of their time and talent on a volunteer basis, at no expense to the ministry. Donations to In His Sign Catholic Radio may be sent to 136 Garrett Avenue, Rosemont, PA 19010, or you can donate securely at inhissign.com. Remember, without your prayers and financial support, our mission voice will be silenced.
And now a word from our sponsor. As a small Franciscan friar watched the Freemasons parade through the heart of Rome, calling for the death of the Pope and the destruction of the Catholic Church, he felt a powerful stirring of the Holy Spirit. It was January 1917. In less than 4 months, our Blessed Lady would appear at Fatima and warn the world what would happen, quote, if man does not turn back to God. That's an exact quote. 5 months after her warning, the Bolsheviks overthrew Tsar Nicholas in Russia, launching a century of atheistic communism that has claimed the life of over 60 million people and enslaved billions. The little friar's name was Father Kolbe. Within days, Father Kolbe gathered 9 other friars in a small room in Rome and founded what he called the Militia Immaculate, better known today as the Knights of the Immaculate, or simply the MI. The MI's mission? To conquer the world for the Immaculate, as Father Kolbe put it. 99 years later, there are over 3 million knights in 50 countries. Each of them shares one thing in common: a total consecration of their life to the Immaculate Heart of Mary for the conversion of sinners. Here in the Mid-Atlantic region, there's over 800 knights, and they live out their consecrations in their families, in their work, and in the apostolic initiatives they either lead or support. And each year, roughly 300 knights gather at the Malvern Retreat House for a weekend of prayer and reflection. Many knights are active in the pro-life movement. Some have started schools and radio stations. Others have published books and CDs and DVDs, led devotional activities in their parishes, and teach and coach youngsters in their communities. All the merit from their good works is given over to the Immaculate to use as she sees fit for the conversion of sinners. On the Day of Judgment, the knights trust that the Immaculate herself will speak for them. Young Father Maximilian Kolbe went on to become a famous saint, a great saint, canonized by his fellow Pole, St. John Paul II. Today he is known all over the world as the Saint of Auschwitz for giving his life for a husband and father of three. He is the patron saint of the pro-life movement and the patron of many radio apostolates, including this one, In His Sign Network. For more information on the MI, please call this station at 610-527-2906. Thank you, and we're back with Edmond Adamus. And Edmond, we were just touching on theology of the body, and what a brilliant response TOB, as they call it, was some 40 years later to the great dissent, I guess you would have to call it, of Humanae Vitae, issued in 1968. It was a brilliant response, and although maybe the entire world hasn't quite caught up to it yet, it will, won't it?
Yes, I think it will, Brian, because there is such a deep, deep yearning and hunger in the hearts and souls of so many people for fulfillment and for love, and to know that they are loved and lovable, and that's, you know, as Christopher West, one of the great popularizers of the body, and others often say, you know, that, you know, turn on the radio or listen to something on a CD player or something on the TV, that there's hardly a melody or a song that isn't talking about love. You know, so, you know, this everyone wants it, but no, not everyone looks in the right place for it or looks for it in the right way. Because, as we know, this is the way we're made, that God has wired us, he hardwired us in our kind of spiritual, supernatural, genetic makeup, if you like. We're wired, our DNA, our spiritual DNA, for total union with him. So the relationships that we encounter in our journey through life, in particular, the most important ones, obviously, from the outset, our parents and others and other close intimates we have through life, and then later, if we're called to marriage and family, our spouse and our children in turn, you know, the quality of those relationships then become the visible, tangible expression of a theology of the body. The truth is everyone, certainly people of goodwill and committed Christians, are striving to live a theology of the body. They may not call it that. They may not articulate it in those terms, but that is essentially what they want, need, and strive to have. So I think my own sense of it is that it will begin to this vision of the human person, this wonderful framework, if you like, that Pope John Paul laid out in teachings to live a dignified call to holiness in service and love one another. In the end, will be something more will want to embrace than they have to take, because you look at the way things are around and you think, it can get any worse, really? you know, I have two children, a two-year-old and a six-year-old, and I worry about the environment my children are growing. But on the other hand, if you dwell too much on the dark, and then you miss out on what is beautiful, true, noble, and good. And it's always what is good and true and noble is always greater than that which is that which is not. And I also feel, I mean, I think certainly whenever I go to America, and I'm thinking in particular of the experience I had in Philadelphia last September during the World Meeting of Families, and not just the talks and the presentations which preceded the papal festivities of different speakers from all over the world, which were outstanding. They were outstanding presentations. But for me, what really hit home was to see hundreds and hundreds of different exhibitors Congress. Such an array of diverse apostolates and movements and initiatives and resources and programs and a whole array of things, wonderful things, all of them really beautiful things, proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ, proclaiming the centrality of marriage and the family and the heart and the mission of the church. And all of that, to me, in a sense, was the fruit, if you like, of that vision of a theology of the Bible. So many of those things in the World Meeting of Families were explicitly to do and related to theology of the Bible. But even those that aren't, in a sense, are caught up in the momentum of it, which I always feel in America in particular, there's a momentum about the theology of the body, which we don't particularly see over here in Britain, and we certainly don't see in Europe. We might see pockets of enthusiasm for it in places like Australia and Canada, but in a sense, America is at the forefront. It's certainly in the English-speaking world, in the Anglophone church, at the forefront of this proclamation of this one truth. And that the truth of the theology of the body, I always say, really boils down to one simple equation. And it's my own paraphrase of a more dense theological definition of John Paul's. And it goes something like this. This is how, kind of theology of the body 101, if you like, theology of the body in one sentence. And it's this. It's that every man, the vocation of every man, is the dignity of every woman. And the calling of every woman is the integrity of every man.
Beautifully put. What do you think is holding back this massive explosion of this truth, this great truth for our time? It is really the defense against the attack on family, and it's a very positive, constructive one that every couple can experience if they understand it, are taught it, embrace it, and live it. And every couple that has swears by it, and according to the data, 99%, 99 plus percent of the families that embrace it and live it are able to stay together. The divorce rate, I think, for those that have gone through this Theology of the Body program in one form or another, is something like 1 in 1,100, whereas the rate in society is 1 in 2. Everybody gets married assuming that they're going to hopefully stay together forever, and yet half don't, and yet divorce is almost unheard of for those couples that embrace this. What is holding back the tremendous tsunami of graces that this gift to the church and the family, John Paul II, gave?
Well, it's a whole number of things, but I do believe there is, ecclesially speaking, there is a kind of structural inertia which has set in about these issues, and I'm speaking from a very obviously a British perspective here. My own experience of living and working in this field and in various dioceses in nearly 30 years now, it's like a benign neglect of this wonderful vision. For fear of offending people, we don't want to kind of push too hard on, you know, kind of key teachings about sexual ethics and human sexuality and natural family planning or natural fertility awareness, as we refer to it now, and the differences between men and women, the complementarity of this of sexual difference now, because of the whole kind of transgender debate. It's all becoming, and obviously what compounded all this, certainly in Britain and in the States too, in society and the changes of legislation regarding marriage in particular, the meteoric rise of so-called gay rights to marriage and everything has put everyone on the back foot, as we say, and has created a climate of fear so that even those, when I say those, I mean clergy and laity alike, even those who fully accept and believe in the church's teaching about marriage and the family and sexuality are kind of stuck in this rigid fake fear that they've allowed to set in, this fear of upsetting people, this fear of not wanting to rock the boat. I can tell you, I can probably count on one hand, or not much more than that, the number of priests I know who preach with some frequency and regularity about the importance of marriage and its beauty and its truth and the gift of sexuality. The rest would never go anywhere near that subject, even on something like the Feast of the Holy Family, where it's kind of allowed, or other moments in the liturgical year. They just wouldn't go near it for fear of upsetting people. At best, it might be a topic they might broach with engaged couples in some way, or might be an
American. And yet attendance at Mass on Sunday continues to fall. No? And not only does it fall, and attendance fall, it's 17% here in the United States, but marriages and baptisms and the use and the frequency of sacraments and the reception of sacraments has been decimated. I think they say that in the Philadelphia five-county area, half of all the children born to Catholic families are not baptized, and that the number of marriages over the last 20 years have been cut in half. We used to have an average of 5.5 children per family 40 years ago. Today it's 1.1. Why this benign neglect in the face of a catastrophic plummet?
Well, again, it's all part of the strategy, if one can use that word, or the campaign, the relentless campaign of the forces of evil, the powers of darkness, and the father of lies, who, what's that phrase in the, I think it's from the book of Apocalypse, where one of the titles for the devil is the false accuser of the brethren.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yes.
And the brethren are listening to his false accusations. So there's this kind of collective inertia is setting in, where people are, you know, most people are trying to live good lives, that, you know, unless they're inherently wicked, most people try to be good. They aim for virtue. They don't willfully choose violence, I think, if they're ignorant on lots of different levels of morality. But they're living in a kind of fog. What they need is the veil to be lifted. They need an apocalyptic experience, an unveiling, in the true sense of that word, apocalypse. They need to have an unveiling, so that the dimmed conscience, the dulled conscience, as John Paul referred to it in Evangelium Vitae, the dulled conscience can be revived and brought back to life again. Something that there's a phrase Pope Francis uses in Amoris Laetitia. It's a beautiful phrase, actually, and it's later on in the document where he's talking about our pastoral care of those who, for whatever reason, their marriages have gone wrong and they find themselves in very complex, difficult situations, and maybe even a second, what have you. And of course, he's talking quite rightly about the pastoral solicitude that pastors in particular in the church must display for individual cases. It's not a one-size-fits-all type of thing, and that's correct. But he goes on to say that, and these are phrases that are not often picked out in the sound bites that we hear about this document, and that is that if someone flaunts their sin, and that's the word he used, they flaunt their objective sin, and doesn't care anything about the church's teaching on marriage and indissolubility, almost as if to say, well, by flaunting it, they might actually bring about a change. You know, he said that that person is really in deep trouble, and in fact, in kind of in scriptural terms, should be rejected by the community. But then he goes on to say, but even that type of person, one might say the abject sinner, even that type of person must, he says, be exposed, the phrase he uses, must be exposed to the pedagogy of grace. Which I think is a beautiful phrase. And to me, I think this is, well, what's the pedagogy of grace? Well, actually, in a sense, that's what we're trying, that's what the body is about. Trying to introduce a new vocabulary to articulate age-old truths in a new way about the call to holiness. I would hope, you know, that you've probably, that there's this, one gets the sense that there's this, in that there's a narrative going on, that there's no kind of continuity or very little continuity from Pope John Paul to Benedict to Francis. Sure, there are, you know, there's differences of style. There's no doubting that. But I think if you dig deeper and you scratch the surface a little bit more, it is very, very possible to read some of the tone and the tenor of what Pope Francis says against the backdrop of John Paul and in the light of Benedict and in the light of the body. So Pope Francis may not say theology of the body, but in Amoris Laetitia he talks very, very clearly and emphatically about the way we should form the hearts and minds of the young and their consciences, and how we should enable them to really properly respect their bodies and the bodies of others. But that's theology of the body. He may not be saying it, but it is. And this phrase that I came across the other day that really sticks out for me, pedagogy of grace. Well, who exercises primordially in the life of the church? Who are the people who exercise the pedagogy of grace day in, day out?
Parents.
Parents are doing it simply by loving their kids the best way they can. What we want is for parents to be engaged at a deeper level so that they're not just nurturing their children and clothing them and feeding them and educating them as all normal, conscientious parents do, but we want the Christian parent to go on another level and actually understand that this child that they have, who's a beautiful gift from God, that they have to, they are responsible not only for their earthly well-being, but they will be held accountable one day for their heavenly well-being.
That notion of accountability is a frightening, it's a frightening reality, isn't it? That we as parents are going to be judged by how we formed our children in the faith.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Many parents would say, well, we're not equipped to. We ourselves weren't taught the faith.
Rightly so. They're not equipped to because, A, we're not telling them from the outset they have this beautiful call. And it's a unique calling because no one loves their child like they love their child. But also, apart from the kind of routine sacramental programs in parish life and diocesan life, all of which are good, don't misunderstand me, they are ostensibly trying to achieve good, they don't go deep enough. It's as if the church, or rather people dip in and out of the life of the church at key moments in the life of their child and in their own life. But there isn't this ongoing formation in between, at least not at a deep enough level. There's pockets of it here and there, for sure, but it isn't always across the board. There isn't a consistency about it. You know what it's like yourself. You know, you can have two neighboring parishes to one another, both completely different in style and fear.
Well, I think the big thing, Edmund, is prayer. If there is not prayer in the home, if the parents aren't frequenting the sacraments, I think it's very hard for them to take their commitment, their accountability very seriously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hey, I want to ask you before we let you go about your blog. It's a phenomenal blog.
Thank you.
I mentioned earlier, over 2,000 people are getting it, and I can imagine many of them are recycling it among their family and friends, as I know I am. How do we get it? And I know Kathleen McCarthy, who runs this network, has said that she would love and intends to post it on our website.
Wonderful, wonderful.
But how can our listeners find this blog and learn from it?
It's a very simple address. It's just edmundadamas.wordpress.com. Edmundadamas.wordpress.com, or if you just Google Edmund Adamas, it's probably quite high up in Google search because there's not many Edmund Adamases in the world.
I can vouch for that.
And you go onto the website and you can sign up to receive the weekly Friday blog I do. I have this weekly blog called The Friday Fast. The idea being that it's reasonably fast to read. And by reading it, you're kind of, it's a little fast from, you know, the scurry of emails you're trying to get through before the end of the week and other things you might be doing on Friday. And it's kind of a thought for the weekend, really, in the realm of deepening people's sense of family spirituality, and matrimonial grace and sanctity.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to sign off. But my dear friend, I'm going to press upon you the need for you to return. You must come back. There are so many more areas of Catholic life and family life that we need to discuss with you. Will you come back?
I will for sure, Brian. Absolutely.
Thank you, and God love and bless you for all the good that you do, and prayers every day for that marvelous family. This man, wonderful husband and father, has two beautiful children, one of whom just arrived, a gift of God. So we're happy for you, Edmund, and we will continue to follow you.
God bless you, and love to all your family.
Thank you, and to all our listeners.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Our Recourse. We are grateful to our sponsors and to Kathleen McCarthy and In His Sign Catholic Radio for bringing this show into your homes and cars. Please remember In His Sign Catholic Radio in your prayers and charitable contributions so we can continue to offer authentic Catholic programming 2 hours every day, 5 days a week. We can be reached at 610-527-2906 or on the web at inhissign.com. Join us next week at this same time for another edition of Our Recourse with Brian Gale.